In our last episode, we traced the origins of the Enlightenment in England and France, but now we're going to head east to Germany and Russia before turning to the, well, the real subject of this series. And that's what all of this has to do with Christian theology. Germany came to the Enlightenment rather late, and I think understandably so. The 30 Years' War had been an almost incomprehensible catastrophe. Estimates vary, but the population of German-speaking lands may have plunged from around 20 million to just 7 million. Entire regions had been depopulated. The cities were burned to the ground. And Germany, properly speaking, didn't even exist. It was more a patchwork of independent statelets, united by language and culture, but divided by the Rhine River, by religion, and by the memory of mutual slaughter. That historical context matters, because it helps explain something curious. Why Germany's greatest intellect was a prophet without honor in his own land. Gottfried Wilhelm von Leibniz was, by almost any measure, one of the most brilliant human beings who ever lived. Born in Leipzig in 1646, the son of a philosophy professor, he studied law, which he apparently found insufficient and took up with a somewhat disreputable circle of alchemists before catching the eye of the Elector of Mainz. He was the kind of man who couldn't walk past an interesting problem without solving it. In 1672, he arrived in Paris on a peculiar diplomatic errand. He wanted to present Louis XIV with a detailed plan for the invasion of Egypt, hoping to redirect the Sun King's territorial ambitions away from Germany. But King Louis was unimpressed with the plan. It came to nothing, though Napoleon would essentially execute a version of it over a century later, which must count for something. But the trip wasn't wasted. Leibniz spent 4 years in Paris meeting every significant mind in Europe's intellectual capital. He taught himself advanced mathematics and promptly invented, are you ready for it, differential calculus, for which generations of college students have been cursing his name ever since. He also showed off a remarkable mechanical calculator that he had built, which impressed the Parisians considerably more than his Egyptian strategy had impressed King Louis. What made Leibniz unusual and what ultimately limited his legacy was that his mind, it simply couldn't stay in one place. He became the court librarian of Hanover in 1676 and then promptly became obsessed with the drainage problems and the Harz silver mines. He spent years inventing windmills and water wheels to solve the problem of the flooding. He served multiple German states simultaneously, drafted civic improvement plans for Berlin and Vienna. He traveled constantly, corresponded with everyone, and produced, in terms of published books, almost nothing. His manuscripts, his letters, notes, it were so many that scholars, they're still working through them, 3 centuries later. He was, in the best and really worst sense, a man who thought faster than he could write and wrote faster than anyone could publish. He died in 1716 in Hanover, largely ignored. His employer at that time was King George I, who had just become the King of England. He didn't even attend Leibniz's funeral. Leibniz was buried by his own request in his long brocade coat, enormous wig, fashions that had been out of style for 30 years, as if to say that he didn't really care what the century's standards were. Now, despite Leibniz's near single-handed effort to kindle a German Enlightenment, you'd have to say the real momentum didn't come until the 18th century, and it was driven by the region of Prussia. Frederick Wilhelm I, who came to the throne in 1713, was a careful, frugal Lutheran who had spent time with Dutch merchants, reformed the economy with Germanic efficiency. But then his son, Frederick II, known to history as Frederick the Great, he had rather different tastes. Upon taking the throne in 1740, he recalled from exile the philosopher Christian Wolff, Leibniz's intellectual heir, as his very first act of governance. He corresponded warmly with Voltaire, spoke French at court, and eventually persuaded the old Frenchman to move to Prussia in 1749. Frederick wasn't just a philosopher king, though. He was also a very busy military one, spending much of the 1740s and 60s in wars that redrew the European map. But he understood that cultural prestige and military power were really two sides of the same coin. Let's turn to Russia now. To the east, a rather more forceful version of Enlightenment was being attempted there. Tsar Peter the Great of Russia was a man of enormous energy and almost alarming curiosity. In the late 17th century, he embarked on what became known as the Grand Embassy. It was an extended tour through Western Europe, during which he worked incognito in Dutch and English shipyards. He visited factories, museums. He essentially tried to download Western civilization directly into his brain. He returned home determined to drag Russia into the modern world. The challenge was considerable. Russia had spent much of the late Middle Ages under Mongol domination, which had effectively walled it off from the intellectual developments that were reshaping the West. It was a deeply Orthodox Christian country, with a church culture almost completely alien to Western Catholic or Protestant sensibilities. When Peter began his reforms, he was working against centuries of inertia. His methods were, well, let's just say they were direct. Beards, which in Orthodoxy carried profound religious significance, were banned. Men who refused to shave were taxed for the privilege of keeping them. There are accounts of older men carefully preserving their cut beards in boxes, terrified that they'd be unrecognizable to God without them. Traditional ankle-length Russian dress was outlawed. Anyone wearing it in public might find it forcibly trimmed on the spot by royal officials with scissors. Western hairstyles became compulsory for women. The Julian calendar was reformed. Military conscription was introduced. And most significantly, the Orthodox Church's hierarchy was brought firmly under state control. Peter abolished the Patriarchate and replaced it with a government committee. The church went from being an independent institution, really, to a department of state. As a symbol of this new westward-facing Russia, Peter built an entirely new capital on the Baltic coast, St. Petersburg, his very location declaring that Russia now faced Europe, not Asia. Peter was hardly what you would call enlightened, though, in his personal conduct. In 1718, he had his own son, Alexei, arrested on charges of treason and tortured to death in the Peter and Paul fortress. Enlightenment principles, it turned out, applied more readily to calendars and hairstyles than to family relationships. The more philosophically coherent face of Russian modernization came with Catherine the Great, a German princess who became Empress of Russia in 1762 by way of a well-organized coup against her own husband. Now, unlike Peter, Catherine had grown up in Western Europe and had genuinely absorbed Enlightenment thinking. She corresponded regularly with Voltaire and the French philosophes. She patronized the arts with exceptional taste, founding what would become the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. Today, it's one of the greatest art collections on earth. As the most powerful monarch in Europe, she extended Russian influence across the continent with a combination of military force and diplomatic sophistication that her contemporaries found either admirable or deeply alarming, depending on where they lived. So, what does any of this have to do with church history? Now, it's a fair question. I've spent this time mapping the Enlightenment's geography, not to give you a European travelogue, but because the cultural and intellectual currents that we've been tracing, that is the confidence in reason, the shift from revealed truth to empirical investigation, the slow loosening of theological authority, these are the waters in which Christian theology now had to swim. The collision between the Enlightenment and Christian faith produces what we call rationalism, and it's the most important theological development of the 18th and 19th centuries. So, I think we need to back up and trace how we got here. The Enlightenment's confidence in human reason, it didn't appear from nowhere. Really, it had been building for about five centuries. It goes back, at least in part, to the 13th century recovery of that Greek philosopher Aristotle. When Albert the Great and Thomas Aquinas reintroduced Aristotelian philosophy to Christian theology, they did something significant. They said that the physical world is knowable, that the senses are reliable, and that reason applied to creation can lead us toward truth. This was a quiet revolution. The older Platonic tradition, which had dominated Christian thought since Augustine, tended to distrust the material world and look inward and upward. Aristotelianism looked outward at rocks and stars, plants, animals, the mechanics of the world as it actually is. The Renaissance amplified this. Its art is saturated with the belief that the human body is glorious, that the natural world is beautiful, that looking at creation is not a distraction from God, but a kind of praise. By the 17th century, many thinkers had concluded that the highest use of reason was understanding nature, that is, mapping it, quantifying it, explaining it. Galileo pushed this further than almost anyone else at that time. He was convinced that the universe was, at its core, a mathematical structure. To understand it fully was to reduce it to numbers and equations. Every successful calculation, every orbit predicted, every trajectory confirmed, it seemed to, well, it vindicate that view. Nature was not mysterious, it was rational. And if nature was rational, then reason was the master key. Out of this atmosphere emerged a man by the name of René Descartes. And that was in the first half of the 17th century, arguably the most influential philosopher of the modern era. Descartes wanted to build philosophy the way Euclid had built geometry, starting from undeniable axioms and constructing everything else through rigorous proof. To do that, he decided that he had to strip away every belief that could possibly be doubted until he found bedrock. So he doubted his senses, he doubted his memories, he doubted the external world. He even entertained the possibility, and this is his famous evil demon thought experiment, that a powerful deceiver might be feeding him false impressions of everything. But then he hit on something he couldn't doubt, the fact that he was doubting. Something was doing the thinking. Whatever else might be illusion, the thinking subject himself existed. Yielding Descartes' famous saying in Latin, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Now from that starting point, he built upward. He argued that he found in his mind an idea of a perfect being, an idea that his finite, imperfect mind couldn't have generated on its own. It must have been placed there by God. Therefore God exists. And if God is perfect, God is not a deceiver. So, the world that his senses perceive is real. Really, it's a remarkable piece of philosophical architecture. And Descartes, who was a sincere Catholic, genuinely hoped that theologians would find it useful. He was somewhat optimistic about that. But several universities condemned his method as dangerous. The problem wasn't the conclusion, that is, that God exists. What they found dangerous was his starting point, universal doubt. To begin by doubting everything looked to many like a crass skepticism dressed up in fancy philosophical clothing. Descartes, it's reported, was so rattled by the controversy that he left France for the relative tranquility of Sweden, where he died in 1650, reportedly from the shock of having to give philosophy lessons to Queen Christina at the age of only 5. His ideas, however, were unstoppable. Cartesianism, as his philosophy came to be called, it spread across Europe and divided thinkers into camps. In France, the Jansenists took it up. Eventually, even the more orthodox came to engage it seriously. The most contentious question that Cartesianism raised was the relationship between mind and matter. If the thinking self is one kind of thing and the physical body is another kind of thing entirely, how do they interact? This question consumed enormous philosophical energy in the late 17th century and produced some genuinely exotic theories. Things like occasionalism and monism, pre-established harmony, which I'm going to spare you, except to note that it generated a spirited and occasionally personal dispute between our friend Leibniz and the Dutch Jewish philosopher named Baruch Spinoza, who had some very unorthodox ideas about what God actually was. While continental philosophy wrestled with Descartes, British thinkers went a different direction. Rather than starting with the mind and working outward, they started with experience and worked inward. This is what we call empiricism, from the Greek word for experience. Its leading voice was John Locke, the Oxford professor whose essay concerning human understanding appeared in 1690. Now, Locke read Descartes carefully and agreed that the order of the mind corresponds to the order of the world, but he rejected Descartes' innate ideas entirely. The mind at birth, he famously argued, is a blank slate, a tabula rasa. Everything we know comes from somewhere, either from the senses or from reflection on our own mental processes. There are no ideas that we're simply born with. This gave Locke a three-tiered account of knowledge. Number one, the knowledge of ourselves. Number two, the knowledge of the world. And number three, the knowledge of God, whose existence can be inferred from the existence of the other two. Now, Locke added a fourth category, the category of what can be known by probability. And this is one of the most useful contributions that he made. It maps closely to how we live. Let's say that you have a friend named George. You know he exists because you've met him repeatedly. When George isn't in the room, you can't prove empirically that he still exists, but sound judgment gives you every reason to think that he, in fact, does. Most of life operates at this level of, that is warranted, substantial probability, rather than some kind of mathematical certainty. So let's call it reasonable certainty. And here's where we turn the corner from all of this philosophical background to its impact on theology and our faith in Christ. Faith, Locke said, belongs in this category of probability, of a reasonable certainty. Faith is assent to knowledge received through revelation rather than reason, and therefore, while highly reasonable, it cannot claim the same certainty as empirical demonstration. From this, Locke drew two consequences that proved enormously influential. First, religious fanaticism, that is the claim that everything one believes is directly revealed by God, is simply bad epistemology. Epistemology is the science of how we know something. And second, religious toleration is rationally required. If faith is always a matter of what is probable rather than what is certain, it's irrational, that is, it's against reason, to persecute people for reaching different conclusions. In 1695, Locke published The Reasonableness of Christianity, arguing that Christian faith is the most rational of religions. The core of Christianity, he said, is belief in God and in Christ as Messiah. Now, this sounds orthodox enough, but there was a catch. Locke didn't think Christianity added anything to what reason could have discovered on its own. Revelation was useful, he said. It was a kind of shortcut, a clear expression of truths that the natural mind could, in principle, have reached by itself. And that, well, that was the open door through which the next generation would walk. And what they'd bring with them was a much sharper knife. David Hume, writing in the mid-18th century, took Locke's empiricism and turned it into something far more corrosive. If I had to identify a single thinker most responsible for the modern habit of the reflexive, almost knee-jerk skepticism that permeated the later Enlightenment, Hume would be my candidate. His target was causation, what causes things. And it's worth following his argument carefully because it's genuinely unsettling once you see what he was saying. Watch a billiard ball strike another. There's a crack, the second ball then rolls away. Watch it again, same result, watch it 100 times. Your mind concludes that the first ball caused the second to move. That's rational, right? Well, Hume said, look again. What have you actually observed? You've seen ball A move, you've seen ball B then move, you've heard a sound, that's it. You've not seen causation. You've seen a sequence of events in your mind, through habit and repetition, has stitched them together with the concept of cause and effect. But that stitching is something your brain does, not something you observed. Strictly speaking, by empiricist standards, causation is not knowledge. It's a mental habit masquerading as knowledge. What Hume was doing, and he knew it, was sawing off the branch that empiricism was sitting on. By tightening the rules of what counts as genuine knowledge until only raw, uninterpreted sense experiences qualified, he made logic, deduction, and inference all technically unjustifiable, irrational. Get this, he crippled the very reason he claimed to be defending. Now, his followers were left with what amounts to philosophical paralysis. We can't prove the sun will rise tomorrow because past sunrises only prove that the sun rose in the past. We can't prove that our friend George still exists when we're not looking at him. We can't, strictly speaking, prove anything beyond the bare data of the moment that we are in. Now, Hume himself was rather intellectually torn about this. He admitted that the moment he left his study and sat down to a game of backgammon with his friends, his skepticism evaporated. He couldn't actually live by his own philosophy, but he also couldn't escape it intellectually. For theology, the consequences were serious. If causation itself is unprovable, the cosmological argument for God's existence, that is, that the universe must have a cause, loses its footing. If miracles are defined as violations of natural law, and natural law is really just observed regularly, then miracles are simply events that conflict with our mental habits, not impossible in principle, just wildly improbable. It wasn't long before some Enlightenment thinkers drew the obvious conclusion and began sketching a world entirely without God. It took a while for these rationalist seeds to germinate in the intellectual soil of Europe and their colonies in the New World. They then blew by the winds of academia to theology and became tares among wheat. We'll chart that in some later episodes. But first, in the next episodes, we're going to catch up with what's happening with the church in New England. And then we're going to close in on the end of our church history series here in the Enduring Word YouTube channel.